Hello from the Mashpee Middle High School, located in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts. My name is Jacob, and I will be reading today's Boston Globe as part of the Audible Local Ledger's High School Student Community Service Program. For over 20 years, the Ledger has delivered information and entertainment to the print-impaired who live on the Cape, the Islands, and the South Coast, many confronting disabilities such as low vision, blindness, or neurological disorders. Mashpee Middle High School is proud to assist in connecting these listeners with the outside world. Now on with today's Globe, dated Tuesday, November 19th, 2019. Our first headline today reads, Ben and Jerry's and the Case of the Happy Cows, Court Considers Suit That Could Curdle Icon's Image, by Dugan Arnett. For decades, Vermont-based Ben & Jerry's has enjoyed a reputation as one of the country's most progressive, forward-thinking companies. From its whimsical packaging to its sizable contributions to a variety of social causes, the company has long billed itself as one of the good guys, a brand of ice cream you could feel good about eating, or as good as one can feel while ingesting 1,000-plus calories per pint. In recent years, however, the business, started by two friends in a converted Burlington gas station, has faced criticism over its own production methods, including a pair of lawsuits accusing the longtime ice cream purveyor of misleading customers about just how humane its products really are. In a class action suit filed last month in federal court in Burlington, Vermont, Ben & Jerry's, along with parent company Unilever, is accused of falsely claiming the milk used in its ice cream comes exclusively from Happy Cows and so-called humane, caring dairy farms. Contrary to the message knowingly conveyed by Unilever to consumers, only a minority percentage of the milk and cream in the products actually is sourced from these Happy Cows on caring dairy farms, alleges the ALLEGESTHE suit. Filed by environmentalist and former Vermont gubernatorial candidate James Ellers. The remaining milk and cream originates from factory-style mass-production dairy operations, exactly what consumers who chose Ben & Jerry's products would like to avoid. Since opening its first store in 1978, Ben & Jerry's has stood as a beloved New England institution, a reputation due in part to its liberal politics and environmentalist claims. Its flavors have occasionally doubled as political statements. Empowerment was released in conjunction with a voting rights campaign, and the company employs an activism manager charged with externally focused campaigns. Its Caring Dairy program incentivizes daily suppliers to meet certain animal care standards, including participation in an animal welfare monitoring program and daily time outdoors for the animals that exceed those of factory farms, which can house hundreds or thousands of cows packed into tight confines. In general, we are proud of the work we've done with Vermont's family farmers over the past 35 years, and we believe in our caring dairy program is the most progressive in the industry, a company spokesman said in a statement provided to the Globe. We're committed to building a resilient, regenerative dairy supply. Ben & Jerry's didn't respond to an email asking what percentage of its milk and cream come from caring dairy farms, but in court documents, the company rejected the notion that it is deceiving consumers, arguing that statements on its website and packaging don't constitute fact-based promises, but rather firmly held beliefs and aspirations. Reasonable consumers, the company adds, wouldn't view the Happy Cow statement as a guarantee that all cows providing milk are located on farms employing more humane practices than typical farms. Some critics, however, remain unmoved, arguing that the company's carefully crafted image of environmental responsibility far exceeds the realities of its supply chain. That's the bind they've got themselves in, says Michael Kobe, an environmentalist activist from Vermont whose battles with Ben & Jerry's date back to its pre-Unilever days. They've done such amazing marketing that they've... That's the bind they've got themselves in, says Michael Kobe, an environmentalist activist from Vermont whose battles with Ben & Jerry's date back to its pre-Unilever days. They've done such amazing marketing that they've convinced people they're doing the right thing when, in fact, they're not. Last month's lawsuit isn't the first time the popular ice cream purveyor has come under fire for its marketing practices. In July 2018, the Minnesota-based Organic Consumers Association filed a similar suit against the company, alleging deceptive labeling, marketing, and sales of ice cream products stemming from the company's claims of using milk sourced from happy cows raised in caring dairies. We look at Ben & Jerry's as really the poster child for greenwashing. This type of deceptive marketing that's used specifically to appeal to customers who want to think that they are buying products that have been responsibly produced, says Catherine Paul, Associate Director of the Organic Consumers Association. The association's suit received a boost earlier this year when a judge denied a motion by Ben & Jerry's lawyers to dismiss, stating that the complaint alleges facts sufficient to advance a plausible claim that consumers would be misled by Ben & Jerry's labeling and marketing regarding the sourcing of its ingredients. The case is pending in District of Columbia Superior Court. Class action lawsuits like the one filed last month can pose unique hurdles, says Alexandra J. Roberts, an associate professor at the University of New Hampshire Law School who specializes in trademark and false advertising laws. According to Vermont's Consumer Fraud Act, she points out, a suit must meet three requirements: a representation, omission, or practice likely to mislead consumers. The consumer must reasonably interpret the message, and the misleading effects must be material, or likely to affect the consumer's decision whether or not to purchase the product. It's not enough to show Ben & Jerry's lied about what kind of farms their milk and cream come from and how those farms treat their cows, Roberts says. A court would also have to find that class members who bought Ben & Jerry's ice cream would likely have chosen a different brand had they known the truth. Historically, similar cases have been difficult to predict. Though Papa John's was temporarily ordered by a federal judge to suspend the use of its popular slogan, "Better Ingredients, Better Pizza," following a lawsuit brought by competitor Pizza Hut in 1998, an appeals court later overturned the decision. In California, a San Francisco judge tossed out a suit brought by people for the ethical treatment of animals, accusing the California Milk Advisory Board of false advertising in a Happy Cows campaign, ruling that government entities aren't subject to false advertising laws. One of the key issues at hand, she says, will be whether the company's caring dairies can be considered a factual claim or just marketing puffery. By defining what caring dairies means, Tushnet says, Ben & Jerry's may well have made a factual claim that could be shown to be true or false. Most Massachusetts single seniors struggle to pay for food, housing study says, by Wiseman Robert. Even in a strong national economy, half of older Americans living alone and nearly one quarter of older couples struggle to afford basic necessities, according to a report that lists Massachusetts as a leading state for elder economic insecurity. Massachusetts tops all states in the share of single people over 65 whose income doesn't cover living expenses such as food, housing, health care, and transportation. More than 6 in 10 here fall short, according to the Elder Economic Security Standard Index, released on Tuesday by the Gerontology Institute at the University of Massachusetts Boston. The state ranks third, after Vermont and New York, in economic insecurity for seniors in two-person households. Nearly 30% of Massachusetts fall below the index. It really comes down to the cost of living, particularly the cost of housing and health care, says UMass Boston Gerontology Professor Jan Mutchler, director of the Institute's Center for Social and Demographic Research on Aging, which has tracked data on income and living costs for older adults over the past decade. Some of the same things that make Massachusetts a good place for younger people to get jobs are also driving up the cost of housing for seniors. About 300,000 seniors in Massachusetts are considered economically insecure, and are about 10 million seniors across the country, according to the UMass Boston Index. The cost of living for older adults in Massachusetts ranges from $26,220 to $39,408 a year for a single person, and from $38,424,000 The cost of living for older adults in Massachusetts ranges from $26,220 to $39,408 a year for a single person, and from $38,424 to $51,612 for a couple, depending on whether they rent, own a house that's been paid off, or own a house on which they're paying a mortgage, the index calculates. In Massachusetts, a hub for higher education and well-paying industries, the findings from the report belie the popular image of prosperous retirees with disposable income. The perception of seniors in Massachusetts is they're comfortable economically, they're well off, and they're looking for leisure activities, said Caroline Villers, executive director of the Massachusetts Senior Action Council, a statewide advocacy group based in Quincy. The reality is the vast majority of seniors here are focused on meeting basic needs. One such senior is Sarah Blakeney, 92, who lives in a Milton apartment and depends largely on her modest Social Security check to cover her rent, food, health insurance, and other expenses. "My rent just went up, and I had dental work," she said. "Thank God I have people from my church who help me out, or I wouldn't be able to afford everything." Mutchler's research, conducted with doctorate students Yang Li and Nidja Velasco-Roldan, compares income data from the U.S. Census with the Elder Index, a country-by-country measure of the income needed by older adults to maintain their independence and meet their living costs while remaining in their homes. The data does not include financial help from families or government supports, such as food stamps, Medicaid, and housing subsidies. Many of the states ranking highest in elder economic insecurity were in the Northeast, where living costs have surged as economies have grown, or in the South, where lower incomes make it harder for seniors to make ends meet, even with a lower cost of living. A breakout for Boston, where costs are higher than Massachusetts or the nation as a whole, found that nearly 3 out of 4 older adults living alone lack the income to cover necessary expenses. Researchers found many seniors fall into an economic security gap, where their incomes, which include Social Security and, for some, wages, savings, and pensions, are too high to qualify for public benefits, but too low to achieve economic stability. "Those who can't get family help sometimes resort to skimping on food or medicine," Mutchler said. "We hear a lot about people making all kinds of adjustments," she said. "They can't avoid paying their rent, but they keep their heat down in the winter or don't turn on the air conditioning in the summer. Some of them don't eat as well as they should, or don't take the medication they need, or don't go to the doctor when they should." The high levels of senior economic insecurity documented in the UMass Boston report should spur policymakers to find ways to create more affordable housing, help older adults pay for rising medical costs, and provide relief from soaring property taxes, says Villar. Villar said the waiting list for affordable senior apartments is 7 or 8 years in Massachusetts cities and towns, while some seniors spend 20% to 30% of their monthly income on health insurance premiums. In response to rising health costs, the Baker administration recently expanded access to a Medicare savings program that allows high-cost states to set income eligibility requirements above the federal minimum. Boston officials, for their part, have adopted a plan to add 2,000 low-income housing units to the 12,800 already available in the city. "We've gone into high gear to build more subsidized housing for seniors," said Sheila Dillon, the city's chief of housing and director of neighborhood development. "We're looking for new sites and new opportunities to build." Both the state government and the city of Boston, where about 31,000 older residents fall below the UMass Boston economic security standard, have taken other steps to improve elder economic security as part of the age-friendly initiatives rolled out in recent years. But they, along with other cities and states across the country, continue to grapple with high costs that fall hardest on their oldest residents, according to the UMass Boston report. It recommended, among other things, efforts to protect Social Security benefits, which account for at least 90% of the income for more than half the older adults who can't afford essential living expenses. It also proposed keeping older employees in the labor force longer at a time, when many businesses and other organizations are finding it difficult to attract workers. A lot of boomers are crossing that retirement threshold and aren't really prepared for the costs they're going to face, Mutchler said. 100 years on, gas taxes need reform. For decades, gas taxes have been the root of the problem. Now, let them be a solution. By Kling Samuel and Stevens Lucas. What a century it's been for the gas tax, the much-scrutinized road funding fee that celebrates its 100th birthday this year. Enacted by the state of Oregon in February 1919, then embraced by every state in the federal government over the following decades, it helped finance the gargantuan infrastructure that gave rise to automobility and remade American life. But now, the program faces two existential challenges. First, as Massachusetts and other states debate a regional green gas tax to fund sustainable transportation, they threaten to upend the entire structure of the program. Second, electric vehicles do not use gas, and fuel economy improvements for gas-powered cars are poised to melt away this hulking glacier of money for road projects. It's only a matter of time before the fee that helped build American road infrastructure vanishes altogether. Good riddance. It's not that Americans should not pay taxes on gasoline. They should. But in an era of climate crisis and crippling traffic, the gas tax creates as many problems as it solves. Gas taxes funnel money into a rotten system, the highway industrial complex, a coalition of construction, auto, real estate, and other... Gas taxes funnel money into a rotten system, the highway industrial complex, a coalition of construction, auto, real estate, and other interests that demand a never-ending list of carbon-spewing new highways and widened roads, regardless of merit. Gas taxes pay for highways, which spur more driving, which swells gas tax revenue, which then pays for more highways. Raising the gas tax without overhauling the system, as 31 states have done since 2013, only entrenches this vicious cycle. Rather than prop up a faltering system, we can fundamentally change it. For decades, state and federal gas taxes funded the bulk of the nation's roads, from rural highways that brought out farmers out of isolation in the 1920s to mid-century interstates that carved through cities and enabled mass suburbanization. But over the course of the 20th century, this funding spigot overwhelmed transportation policy making. A recent Transportation for America report shows states built so many unneeded roads they cannot afford to maintain them. Road networks have grown so unwieldy that gas taxes now fund less than half of their cost. Gas taxes provide an automatic source of funds, with most reflexively routed to roads and highways. A smaller portion goes to the transit and other uses. As a result, much higher funding bypasses debate. The funds also get spent according to flimsy logic. Highway boosters say road expansion fixes congestion, and thus benefits the environment. They argue car traffic behaves like a liquid, a constant flow that becomes less dense with more space. In fact, it behaves more like a gas, expanding to fill the space given to it. Widened highways soon attract cars seeking quicker routes. The phenomenon, known as induced demand, is so widely recognized that economists call it a fundamental law of congestion. As a result, traffic and emissions grow as road capacity grows. Each new mile of six-lane highway pumps out 600,000 tons of carbon dioxide over its lifespan, according to the Sightline Institute, equivalent to 9,000 flights between New York and Los Angeles. No wonder transportation in the U.S. generates more greenhouse gas emissions than any other sector. Thankfully, we can turn this cycle around. The green gas tax, with revenue directed towards sustainable transportation, is a start, but existing state and federal gas taxes must also be reformed. State leaders should treat gas taxes as a carbon tax, a tool to reduce emissions. Under this framework, using gas taxes to build highways is akin to using cigarette tax proceeds to plant tobacco fields. Instead, direct real money to high-quality transit, safe cycling facilities, and robust pedestrian infrastructure that will lessen people's need to drive and clear space for drivers who have no other choice. give more autonomy and funding to cities, which tend to be more forward-thinking on transportation than state governments. Dense urban areas are the most fertile ground to strengthen non-driving transportation options. Finally, stop building roads where they aren't needed. Induced demand can work in a productive direction. Sensible road infrastructure and humane streets can learn people out of cars, save money, and build more sustainable cities. For decades, gas taxes have been the root of the problem. Now, let them be a solution. Drawing the line between Deval Patrick's private and public self, with Patrick's late splash into 2020 presidential waters, he's selling himself as the centrist alternative to former Vice President Joe Biden, whose troubles putting public interest above his private loyalties are also generating headlines. By Vinacci Joan. As the governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick once said he understood he didn't get to draw a line between my private self and my public self. He got woke, as you might call it today, only after he got caught making a phone call on behalf of a mortgage lender on whose board he once sat. He blurred the line again before he left office in 2014 when he ousted two state officials who wanted to put his brother-in-law on a sex offender registry after a rape conviction. With Patrick's late splash in 2020 presidential waters, both incidents deserve news scrutiny, especially since he's selling himself as the centrist alternative to former Vice President Joe Biden, whose troubles putting public interest above his private loyalties are also generating headlines. See Hunter Biden and Burisma. Patrick's private sector resume is already causing trouble with the Democratic base. When he left the governor's office, he took a job with Bain Capital, a private equity firm routinely bashed by Democrats, along with its co-founder Mitt Romney. And before he was elected governor in 2006, Patrick worked as general counselor for Texas and Coca-Cola, and was on the board of AmeriQuest, a subprime mortgage lender that contributed to the Great Recession of 2008. Meanwhile, his public sector resume raises even more questions about his ability to put private loyalties aside, be they corporate or family. A few weeks into his first term, Patrick contacted Robert Rubin, the former Clinton Treasury Secretary who was then a top executive at Citigroup, and asked him to rescue the financially sinking AmeriQuest. When Citigroup quickly extended a line of credit, and Patrick's call came under scrutiny, he said he was acting as a private citizen, not as a governor. But as he eventually acknowledged to then-Globe columnist Eileen McNamara, I don't get to draw a line between my private self and my public self. Maybe I'm resisting that a little bit, and that's why I keep making these stupid mistakes. The situation involving Patrick's brother-in-law is more complicated, but still raises judgment questions. Bernard Tsai has been convicted of raping his wife, Patrick's sister, in California in 1993. He was outed as a convicted sex offender near the end of the 2006 gubernatorial campaign in what seemed to be a last-minute Republican orchestrated hit. After Patrick's election, a hearing officer from the Sex Offenders Registry Board determined Tsai did not have to put his name on the registry. However, two other officials disagreed and sought to overturn that decision. The hearing officer filed a whistleblower suit against the board and eventually received a $60,000 settlement from the state. Tsai, meanwhile, was convicted last summer of again raping Patrick's sister, who is now his ex-wife. He's now in jail. Shortly before he left his office, in 2014, Patrick ousted the two women, one a board member and one the executive director, who tried to overrule the hearing officer. The former executive director has filed her own whistleblower suit against the state, and that case is still pending. Patrick contends that Massachusetts law backed up the hearing officer's initial findings and that the ousted director has unlawfully intervened in the decision. Yet as Gina Scaramella, executive director of the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center, told The Globe, there's often decisions made about how to handle specific offenders that are based on positional power. From that perspective, she said, It could be that the executive director was trying to avoid any suggestion that Sai was getting special treatment. This is obviously painful history for the Patrick family. Up against President Trump's crude embrace of private interest over public, these matters may seem small. But the country needs a president who understands once they take the oath of office, they stop being a private citizen. Patrick may not be as woke about that as he wants us to believe. This is the end of part one of today's Boston Globe recording for Tuesday, September 19th, 2019.
Hello from the Mashpee Middle High School. This is Lynn Weeks, the school librarian, bringing you part two of today's Boston Globe recording. Our next headline is, Assume Trump is impeached, then what? We are entering dangerous waters, by Andrew Bakovich. Can newspapers and news networks salivate? To judge by the coverage of the rapidly accelerating impeachment process, one might think so. In every corner of the prestigious media, print or electronic, Fox News always excepted, a palpable sense of anticipation is evident. A greatly feared and much-loathed predator, now badly wounded, is being run to ground. After a long and frustrating chase, his pursuers are closing in for the kill. The end is approaching, or at least it appears to be. This describes the hopes of many millions of our fellow citizens, whose love of country I would not presume to question. More than a few of them see President Trump's removal from office as necessary to save America and preserve our democracy. They may be right. Yet assume success? Assume Trump's ouster? Then what? Under the terms of our Constitution, Vice President Mike Pence will succeed to the presidency. Optimists might hope that our present crisis will thereby pass, Americans setting aside their differences to rally around their new commander-in-chief. For at least three reasons, this is not likely to happen. First, as Trump's most loyal, make that supine, lieutenant, Pence will command little legitimacy outside the ranks of the Republican Party. He will lack real authority to govern, and from day one will be the lamest of lame ducks. Don't expect a replay of 1974, when Gerald Ford's ascent to the presidency, replacing the disgraced Richard Nixon, elicited a collective sigh of relief. For all who despise Trump, President Pence will become an instant target of contempt. Second, the relentless approach of another presidential election, less than a year away, will pour yet more fuel on the flames of partisanship. Send Trump packing, and the aftermath won't be reconciliation. The political war that began Trump's 2017 inauguration will continue, with gloves off and no prisoners taken. The most extreme elements of both the right and the left will command center stage, with moderates marginalized. In God Save the Republic, Trump himself just might take another ride down the escalator and declare himself a candidate. If you think that's unthinkable, think again. Third, and most important, Trump's removal may well impart new energy to Trumpism. The aggrieved who vote him into office won't quietly accommodate themselves to what the president's defenders are already loudly and defiantly insisting amounts to little more than an attempted coup. Rather than preserving the Constitution, impeachment followed by conviction in the Senate will subject the Constitution to stress not seen since the Civil War. So we are indeed entering dangerous waters. The anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, 30 years ago this month, offers a timely reminder of how suddenly a seemingly stable political order can come apart. Allow me to make two modest suggestions that might reduce the likelihood of the United States suffering the fate of East Germany, the Soviet Union, and the entire Soviet Empire. First, serious journalists should recover a modicum of balance. To succumb to Trump derangement syndrome only validates the tabloid-style sensationalism of those publications lower down on the journalistic food chain. Everywhere today there is hyperbole, a tendency furthered by the virtual collapse of any distinction between reportage and commentary. Trump's charges of fake news are manifestly self-serving. What citizens are actually offered today is Manichaean news, with the lines between right and wrong, good and evil, bright and definitive. Yet truth is always almost complicated, as will the truth of what the nation is experiencing today eventually will prove to be. So reporters and editors should take a deep breath and return to their calling, reporting the news rather than presuming to expound upon its significance. They owe it to the country in its time of need. Second, members of Congress should think about the day after, the wreckage that Trump's removal from office will leave in its wake. Would that our political system allowed for some equivalent of ancient Sparta's Council of Elders, a group of wise and mature citizens able to rise above the controversies of the moment and chart a way forward. We have no such body to which we can turn. Somehow, now, when the loudest and most impassioned voices are those coming from the far right and the far left, what little remains of a political center needs to recover its gumption. The center, not the extremes, must find a way to restore civility and, by extension, the possibility of restoring actual governance after Trump. That way lies the possibility of salvation. Next, I'm going to read today's Boston Globe obituaries. Jared Hopestill Adams of Holliston, Massachusetts. Bruce T. Amsbury of Needham, Massachusetts. Nancy M. Benenchi, BENECCHI, of Wakefield, Massachusetts. Sister Sarah Ann Buckley of Scituate, Massachusetts. John F. Burns of Somerville, Massachusetts. Dora M. Carter of Wellesley, Massachusetts. Carol Ciccoletti, CICCOTELLI, of Malden, Massachusetts. John F. Cody, Jr., of Carlisle, Massachusetts. William E. Cohen, of Andover, Massachusetts. Virginia Comley, of Bedford, Massachusetts. Chester J. Confaloni, CONFALONE, of Wakefield, Massachusetts. Rita R. Connolly, of Lexington, Massachusetts. And Kathleen M. K. Cully, CULLY, of Milton, Massachusetts. I have reached the end of our reading for today. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, or you're interested in either volunteering or donating to our nonprofit to keep us on the air, it is tax-deductible, please call 508-539-2030 or visit our website, audiblelocalledger.org. You can now listen to us on smart speakers like the Amazon Echo Dot and Google Home. Just say, smart speaker, Alexa or Google, play radio station Audible Local Ledger on TuneIn, and you'll have a clear, static-free connection to our readings. As always, thank you for listening and for all of your continued support. This is Lynn. Bye for now.